ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr, and a big hello to our Perth listeners now hearing us on FM. Yes, FM radio 103.3. While John Howard was Prime Minister, Helen Clark was Prime Minister on the other side of the water. Different leaders. She was the one who decided to rescue the refugees we put on Nauru. She upheld New Zealand's refusal to have nuclear ships in its ports. When she left office, Helen Clark became one of the leading figures in the United Nations, and she's now campaigning for a woman to become the next Secretary General of the world body, the next and the first. I'll be talking to Helen Clark later in the show. We will be ranging widely. But first, it's Monday, and we begin the week, as we always do, in Canberra, with Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. Anna, hello.
Good evening, David.
For the last week or so, Angus Taylor, the new leader of the opposition, has been repeating over and over in one way or another, we welcome all who share Australian values. When you look at what the coalition has been up to in that time in the last week or so, what Australian values do you think they're displaying?
Such a big question, isn't it? I mean, the whole purpose, and I think from the very first couple of sentences of Angus Taylor's kind of acceptance speech when he addressed the media after winning the leadership was to immediately talk about the importance of a very stringent immigration system. So what does it mean to be Australian? Who should be Australian? And why Australians should be worried about other people who are trying to get into the country. And so the Australian values that he and Jane Hume have been talking about and have sort of displayed in the policy that they have unveiled now is about a version of Australia which is you subscribe to be Australian. I think there is a type of migration that he's very welcoming of, and Jane Hume has also spoken about this, and this is people who come to Australia to contribute to the community. The difference between One Nation and the Liberal Party is that it's okay, according to the Liberal view of Australian values, that you have a different multicultural attitude and you bring a different element from perhaps another country to bring to the Australian melting pot, for want of a better word. But at the same time, you know, One Nation, for example, wants a monoculture. They don't want multiple languages spoken. They don't want people.
None of that.
Perhaps looking at a different religious view or other views that they're going to bring to Australia, and they're going to prioritise first over being Australian. So the very clear message from the Liberal Party is that there will be changes that they would make to the immigration structure and to the threshold by which someone who wants to come to Australia would prove that they would exhibit those Australian values through some kind of test or some kind of additional, you know, jump that they'll have to make, which will largely, I think, from what I can gather, probably be some kind of additional test on top of citizenship if they got into government and could get this through.
More searching questions in the questionnaire that new arrivals have to answer.
Some kind of patriotism credo seems like something that was on the table, but it's really unclear. And, you know, it's an issue that has been picked up on and is clearly of great interest in the Australian community at the moment. And different political parties are approaching in different ways. And I don't think we've got the fully formed Liberal policy. Well, we obviously don't, because they're nowhere near unveiling that. But as I said, David, in those first words that Angus Taylor said, he said, we'll shut the door on people who hate Australia. And they have immediately then sort of executed their plan to focus really in on anyone involved with the Islamic State in particular as an example of what they're not willing to accept.
So they are raging about the dangers to Australia of 11 women, 11 ISIS, so-called ISIS brides, 11 women and 23 children. And I'm wondering if one of the Australian values they're displaying here is panic.
There is such a heightened concern in the Australian community about the potential for another terrorist attack on Australian soil after Bondi. And I think that's very recognised by a number of political parties, including by the government now. So the opposition, in crafting a policy, which to be fair has focused on what the Liberal Party has seen as major inconsistencies in the process around this group of women and children who've been in the detention camp in Syria now for, you know, many years. This, while it feels like it's sort of come to a fever pitch in the last couple of weeks, you know, this is an issue which has been prosecuted in the parliament, in Senate estimates, and more broadly in their rhetoric for many, many months.
Oh, indeed, years. Indeed, years. These women have been terrifying Australia for years.
But it's changed. The tenor of the debate has changed because of what happened in Bondi and because it was an IS-inspired attack. You can understand that there is now a view, particularly in conservative parties, that it's not appropriate. Like, you can understand that they see the value in now saying that, you know, why would we risk in any way having anyone come back to Australia who's lived within that environment, who may well have been radicalised or brainwashed, and who they say chose to travel to Syria when it was well known that the caliphate was operating and joined grouping.
But there's some doubt, isn't there, Anna, about how much these women were actually volunteers for the life that they've lived.
I mean, Tony Burke made it pretty obvious in his interview on the ABC yesterday that there was a diversity of experiences, as he saw it, amongst those who are affected by this. And it is important to make clear, when we talk about 34 people, as you've made clear, 11 adults are in this group. The rest are the children. And some of them were born in Syria and some of them have never lived in Australia, but they're Australian citizens. And their families are in Australia desperately wanting to have them back and to support them to de-radicalise and to somehow live a different life in Australia. But yes, there is a diversity of clearly positions for these women, one of whom we know has a temporary exclusion order applied to them. So whatever they were involved in has met a particular threshold where they can be locked out of the country for up to 2 years. But it's not clear at all on the public record exactly how many of the other 10 women would actually face any criminal action in Australia whatsoever if they fly back in, use their one-use-only passport they've been issued and come back. And I think it's quite clear from what Tony Burke said that not all of them would. And we know from the group that have already returned, or the multiple groups that have already returned, that some have faced some prosecution, and there are prosecutions about joining a terrorist organisation and going to a prohibited area that can be applied by the Australian law. But, you know, at the same time, some of these women, we were told by Mike Burgess from ASIO 2 years ago, don't actually have any security threat that they are particularly aware of. And when I went back to ASIO this week to ask their media team for an update on that advice or any further change to that position, they just quoted my interview back to me.
Good.
So
you as an authority for you. But Anna, let's go a bit deeper here, and I'm very serious about this. What is their Australian value of lawfulness being exhibited by the coalition at the moment? Australian citizens cannot be excluded, ultimately cannot be excluded from Australia. You cannot legislate around that. That is a fundamental principle of law, and the High Court has laid it down unequivocally. They have to come home. If there are any dangers associated with them, they can be charged, as usual, and face trial. That's what we call the law. They are coming up with a notion at the moment of making it illegal for, this is the coalition, to make it illegal for somebody to assist in doing what is absolutely legal. Now, what is the value of law in their minds? Jonathan Dunningham, Shadow Minister for Home Affairs, said today, constitutional risk is not a reason to do nothing. What does that mean?
Well, it means that they're willing to test the Constitution. They're willing to test willingness of lawyers to take it to the High Court. They're willing to say, you know, in the priority list that there is a view within the opposition that all possible measures to try and prevent this group returning should be implemented.
But and, they can't stop this group returning. They can't do it.
Well, I think there's two things at play here. One is the view that these people shouldn't return to Australia. We know constitutionally, and it's been made very clear by the eminent likes of Don Rothwell, for example, that there is nothing that can stop these people coming into Australia. The second thing is that I think that the opposition's position is largely also about putting forward the idea of saying we should do everything we can to stop these people and we want to put laws into the parliament and the government should support them. And if the government doesn't support them, well, the government is supporting terrorism. So there is a political lens around that, which is about putting the government in a position to have to choose and then deal with the sort of ramifications of that. But there's another element to this story as well, David, in terms of how the government is approaching the same question, because the Prime Minister has made clear, you know, that these people have made their bed, they should lie in it. While in 2019, he's on the record as saying he has sympathy for the children, they deserve Australia's protection. He has really altered his language in terms of the children now and is extremely muted in his view of what should happen to them. That the mothers in this case do not want to be separated from their children, which I also think is an important thing to note. That there is, in other examples, there have been children who've been removed separately, but there has been a view taken in Australia that separating parents and children is a bad thing to do.
That's an insight. That's extraordinary insight, isn't it?
But also, the other thing that I think is really interesting to note in all of this is, as I understand it from talking to our contacts in Syria and talking to the camp officials at the camp where the women are being kept and then also talking to the Syrian officials, that what has happened is the women and children were issued with passports and the camp wants them out because they want all foreign nationals out to be dealt with by their own governments. They've travelled in this bus to a point where they then have to be handed over to Syrian officials. And the Syrian officials, taking over this group from the Kurds, have panicked because they're confused that the Australian government is saying we don't want these people to return, but they have passports. So the Syrian approach, as I understand it, has been we must respect the Australian government's wishes, that they don't actually want this to happen. Even though what the Australian government has been saying is we have a policy that if you get back to Australia yourself, that's up to you. We're not going to repatriate you.
So 11...
The government
11...
as well is finding a way to put up a roadblock.
11 women and 23 children. On Late Night Live, this is David Marr. I'm talking to Anna Henderson. Anna, in the few moments we have left, Pauline Hanson has always been opening her mouth for years and years and years, but suddenly she's being reported. And the other day we heard her absolutely clear-voiced announcing her contempt for Muslims. Now, let's have a look quickly at some of her other policies, because when you look at them, they're pretty, they're fascinating. Fake science drives false climate change claims. What have you turned up?
Some of the things that struck me were kind of expected. You know, coal and gas needs to continue and be increased, for example. But also, you know, in that climate policy area, they go a lot further because they say the department, like the entire Department of Climate Change, should be abolished. as well as getting rid of all renewables projects, as well as withdraw from the Paris Agreement, you know, Trump style an agreement there. And they've docked a $30 billion saving from that. So that's, you know, a significant amount of money they can see from getting rid of that. The ramifications of doing that in terms of the international structures that Australia signed up for on the future of the planet are quite mind-blowing.
Anna, thank you for joining us once again on Late Night Live. Coming up, I'm talking...
Well, David, you got to let me say thank you.
Oh, Anna, thank you for joining us once again on Late Night Live.
Well, thank you, David, for having me. I look forward to delving deeper into these policy areas in the future.
We shall. Coming up, Helen Clark. Antonio Guterres's time as Secretary General of the UN ends on December the 31st. And the search for his successor is well underway. It's a contrary process that's always put a man in the top job. So this time, more strongly than ever, there's an argument that the UN should at last be led by a woman. Making that case is GWL Voices. GWL stands for Global Women Leaders, 79 of them from 39 countries. In their recent report on where women stand in the global hierarchy, they birch not only the UN, but a number of international organisations never led by a woman. My next guest is one of the founders of GWL Voices, former Prime Minister of New Zealand and former head of the UN Development Programme, Helen Clark. Helen, welcome back to Late Night Live.
Thank you.
Why should the Secretary General of the United Nations be a woman?
Isn't it time? This is the 10th election of a Secretary General. There has never been a woman Secretary General. There have been very few women candidates ever for Secretary General, actually a total of 8 in the 80 years to date. We will have competent women standing, and it is time to change what happens and get a woman at the top.
What would a woman bring to the United Nations?
So firstly, it's a signal, as when women get to the top of any country or big organisation, that no doors are closed to women. And clearly the door at the UN at the top and in a number of other places around the international system has been firmly closed. So it's that signalling that for women they can aspire to and reach the top. But secondly, I think there are so many issues the UN deals with where it would be nice to see a woman's touch for a time. Take, for example, something like the UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security, always more observed in the breach. A woman with a focus on issues like that, what's happening to women in the conflicts of the world, would be a nice change.
You've also remarked in the past that women would bring energy. What is your critique of men in that comment, that they would bring energy for change?
I think the election of a woman would symbolise tremendous change. And of the women who already have put their hands up, I've no doubt they'd bring change. They are women in a hurry. They're very experienced women. They know what they want to do when they get there. Look, this is a soft power position. Now, you can sit back and do nothing and say, my hands are tired, I've got no power. Or you can say, this is the world's top diplomatic position and I'm going to go for it. I'm going to use every soft power tool I have to address the world's conflicts and many other challenges.
You went for it in 2016. What was it like to stand for the top diplomatic job in the world? What did you face?
In retrospect, it was harrowing. But when you're in the middle of the campaign, you keep going because you clearly have enough support to think that you might have a chance at least of winning. But when you reflect on it, it was never going to happen for a range of reasons. One, the majority of the candidates were women and none ever were the top pollers in the contest, which tells us something. Secondly, I was putting my hand up from the Western European and others group To be honest, I don't think a New Zealander, Australian or a Canadian is ever going to get through that group because it's mainly Western Europe and they know each other from the European Union processes.
We're Western Europe out here, are we?
We are part of Western Europe and others. So we're sort of on the periphery of that group. We'd be on the periphery probably of an Asia-Pacific group if we were in that. But the geopolitical, the geography, not really conducive to someone from our part of the world.
Why was it harrowing?
Well, because it eventually dawns on you that there's a hidden hand. Doesn't matter how well you do in any public interview, any appearance before the General Assembly, the fact that you will get a favourable press from those who follow the contest closely. None of that mattered because the hidden hand was these five vetoes at the Security Council. The other 10 members, the elected members, of course their votes are important because that's what's going to get you the numbers to get into the into a shooting position, as it were. But I ended up with 3 vetoes and 1 abstention, so I wasn't going to make it.
So that really, although it poses as an election, as an open election, this position is chosen behind closed doors.
It's chosen behind closed doors. It tends to go, at least to date, to the, you know, the lowest common denominator on what everyone can agree on, the permanent five. And let's face it, there's a range of views between them. So if you work through who's the US going to veto, who's Russia going to veto, who's China, France, UK going to veto, you come down to probably quite inoffensive people and not strong leadership. This is the other factor. For women to get anywhere near running for a position like this, you have to be quite a strong character because you battled your way through to get to the top and be in this position.
You've made yourself a contender.
You've made yourself a contender. But then the word Secretary General implies a spectrum. It runs from Secretary to General. So the women tend to be more down the general end. This is terrifying to a lot of people who've never experienced women leadership in their country or their organisation or institution. Also, very few women ambassadors at the United Nations. It's usually somewhere between 20 to 30 out of the 193, 194 members. So it's not a conducive atmosphere for women.
Has António Guterres provided strong leadership?
Well, he's had a very difficult run, I think. He's now in the second Trump presidency. And with Trump presidencies, the money disappears from the UN system. It seems a bit hopeful they might pay something now, but on what conditions, who knows. But it's not easy. And it's not easy when great powers, with a veto, themselves flagrantly breach the UN Charter. And there's evidence of that on all sides. I remember when I was New Zealand Prime Minister and we came out strongly against the invasion of Iraq by the UK, US, and supported by a very small number of friends.
And Australia, of course.
Australia, Spain. And our position at the time was, if you're going to support this, the country invading another without a UN mandate, don't come grumbling when another great power of a different political disposition does the same. Well, of course, the Russians and backed secession in Georgia. They had the first invasion of eastern Ukraine in 2014, then tried to go the whole hog in 2022. I mean, where is the moral authority of the US, the UK on these kinds of issues now? So when the great powers are breaking the rules, the Secretary General is left trying to stand up for international law, but having those who should be upholding it abusing it.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Helen Clark, former New Zealand Prime Minister, and now a power in the United Nations. Helen, the Global Women Leaders Report, it's the third or fourth report into where women are in power in the world. Where are women in power, and what is holding them back?
Well, what holds women back is sheer misogyny. It's not lack of ambition. I recall doing an event for a financial services conference in recent years, and the research said, here's what happens in a sector like this, and it's common in many sectors. The women come in as, you know, more or less equal in the number of new recruits. And they are ambitious. They apply for things. They get a lot of knockbacks. And so by the time you get to the middle level, the women have dropped away in numbers and the men have got their career set for the top. The World Economic Forum does a report every year on the gender gap. And, you know, usually it's telling us that on current trends, it would take something like 100 years to get equity in the world's parliaments or something like that, let alone economic parity. So it's not about women not wanting to get ahead, not aiming for the top. It is sheer misogyny.
You've also remarked that there are strengths in women that are regarded more broadly as sort of drawbacks for having women as leaders. Is it a fear of strong women, not particularly deep down in men?
Well, I was told in the course of the Secretary General campaign when I ran that my strength was my weakness. But you can't come forward pretending to be something that you're not. And in any case, no one would want a weak Secretary General. So they've got you coming or going. They don't want you strong, but they don't want you weak. This is the challenge. But this was apparent to me when I was first coming up through New Zealand politics, that there hadn't been a woman in the role before. Media weren't used to it. The public wasn't used to it. So they tended to focus on things that were not very important, whether it was appearance or the level of your voice or whatever, or how you were dressed or whatever, and commented on all kinds of aspects except how you might do the job, which they had no idea about. So women have to battle through all these kinds of barriers, things that men would never face.
But aren't we getting used to it now?
Well, not especially. You know, look at a country like the United States, never had a woman president. It's rejected two incredible candidates, Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris, even a vice president,
and
Geraldine Ferraro.
Who beat them both? Who beat those women?
Donald Trump, who played
he can only, that, there's a
male
a man,
constituency.
There's a man who can only beat a woman. I mean, what kind of strength has Donald Trump got?
Well, he's proven to be a winner. He speaks to the crowd.
And he speaks to misogyny.
Yes, he does.
Mm. Have you any advice to give the Liberal Party in Australia about how to get more women in their ranks? How did you get more women into the ranks of the Labor Party in New Zealand?
The big leap forward in New Zealand on women's representation in Parliament was changing the electoral system. It was pretty slow progress before that. In 1993, we'd got up to 20%, and then when the proportional representation system came in 3 years later, it immediately leapt to 30, and then it just kept going up because in the end, parties worked out that you couldn't credibly present to the electorate with a slate of candidates on a list and in constituencies which didn't have women well represented. So you now find the women coming from across the political spectrum and parties, and frankly across abilities too. You know, not all women are great MPs or ministers, but in terms of representation of that, the gender being woman, we're doing okay.
There's a kind of feeling out there, I know I'm old, so maybe I'm just going back to my own ignorant middle age, that, you know, if we could only get women into leadership, they would be decent and sensible and progressive and we would have better politics. But when we look around now, women aren't necessarily going to be progressive, decent and intelligent leaders.
Mm. No, and there's some rather sobering examples, aren't there? Take the relatively recent election in Tanzania. A woman president had come in when the previous president had died in office, a COVID denier who died of COVID. And when she ran for election, there was, you know, a lot of feeling that it was time for a change from the party which has ruled since independence. The opposition was violently repressed. A lot of people were killed in protests, particularly after the election. A lot were detained, political leaders intimidated, beaten, etc. So this ain't great. You know, we saw in India with Mrs. Gandhi when she declared martial law. We've seen Sheikh Hasina driven from power after, again, a lot of repression. So let's not pretend all women are saints at all. They're not. But the principle still applies that women should have a fair shake at the job and be judged on the merits of what they can do.
What's the position of Marine Le Pen at the moment? She's She's been sidelined from politics in France because of some,
she faces various criminal charges which would stop her running as president, but she has a protege who would run and carry out her bidding.
Very well organised. Would that protege be a woman or a man?
It's a man. And let's face it, she's probably in the leadership position she's been in because her father was the leader. And this is a very old pattern of how women initially
of course,
come
Gandhi.
Up in the political system. Well, the daughter of. And in New Zealand, among the early women members of parliament, a lot were the widow of or the daughter of. That was the pattern.
Mm. Did New Zealand settle down in the, 10 or 11 years that you were prime minister? Did they settle down to having a woman?
Yes. So I was preceded by Jenny Shipley, who came in a party room coup, not unknown in Australia either. And Jenny had 2 years. And to be honest, that was the luckiest break I ever had because I was facing a lot of, you know, headwind as a leader of the opposition, the first woman to, you know, aspire to the job of PM. And suddenly the National Party produced a woman prime minister. And so it became clear that whoever you voted for, you were going to have a woman prime minister. It neutralised the issue. I think that was extremely helpful. But when you had the 9 years then in between me and Jacinda Ardern coming, people kind of forget a bit about women and the strengths they can bring. And Jacinda faced a lot of obstacles. And
as a woman?
As a woman, yeah. As a young woman too. You know, the issue of the talkback host who demanded to know whether she would have children if she was elected. And of course, when she asked, well, you know, what business is that of yours? He said, well, we need to know whether the Prime Minister can take time off work. Now, who asks whether a male Prime Minister, who, you know, there's a new baby coming along, whether they're going to take time off work?
Bit of paternity leave.
Yeah.
Mm. Helen, while you're here, can you explain for us this contradictory nature of New Zealand? On the one hand, conservative, quite deeply conservative, but on the other hand, willing to be radical. What is it about New Zealand where those two things seem to sit side by side?
I've seen New Zealand as really quite a progressive country, but it does have significant periods of regression, and we are in one of them now. I think that, you know, the way some of the politics and trends of the US play out down under can be a bit worrying. Now, in the end, the last Australian election seemed to see off the contender who was probably seen as too MAGA-like. But in New Zealand, you know, we have Winston Peters doing rather well with his anti-woke, anti-DEI, anti-vaccine, anti-science, anti-this, anti-that. I mean, not to anything like major party status, but, you know, enough to stay. And that speaks to worrying trends, I think.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Helen Clark, former NZ Prime Minister. Helen, you talked earlier about the damage done to world order by the invasion of Iraq. What damage do you see has been done by the campaign in Gaza by Israel?
Last year, I went to Cairo and to the Rafah crossing with Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland. We're members of the Elders. A very sobering experience. And we met with exiled Gazans in Cairo. And I remember one very eminent jurist saying to us, don't let Gaza be the place where international law dies. Well, in many ways, it has died there because there are war crimes, crimes against humanity committed, you know, by the zillion with impunity. Will anyone ever be held accountable? The International Criminal Court prosecutor laid charges against both Hamas leaders, who I think are now all dead, and the Prime Minister of Israel and possibly others in his cabinet as well. And for their pains, the US has sanctioned the judges, the prosecutor, their families, to the extent I'm just reading that a Canadian judge is speaking about the fact that her credit cards were all cancelled.
Yes.
Internationally, she can't access her Amazon or Uber account. I mean, this is incredible. This is a full-scale assault on international law.
A little detail. Why do those judicial proceedings at the UN take so long?
Well, the International Criminal Court has never tried very many cases. There is, under the Rome Statute, which set it up, a principle of complementarity where it says that really countries should be trying these crimes themselves. But the International Criminal Court can deal with the, you know, the gang leader, as it were. But a court system at home should deal with arrest. Well, fat chance in a lot of cases. So it takes a long time to gather evidence, obviously, in jurisdictions that aren't very helpful. And really, it will never be able to do more than pursue a few ringleaders, but then hope that somewhere, sometime, a government in a country will come along and deal with the issues. Take, for example, what happened in Argentina over many, many years. Argentina kept trying people who'd committed crimes under the junta for decades. That's the way it should be.
Yes. Do it at home.
Do it at home.
Do it at home. Yeah. Back to the Rafah crossing. When you were there, it was still closed. What do you know now of the situation where the crossing is said to be open?
It's open to only a very limited degree. I understand that there could be as many as 20,000 people who require medical evacuation, and all you're seeing is a trickle across the Rafah border each day. People are dying in Gaza, not only from bombing, which continues. Obviously, there's been more than 600 people killed since the so-called ceasefire came into effect. People are dying of injuries that can't be properly treated. They're also dying of other things that they can't get proper treatment for, whether it's your cancer, your heart disease, your stroke, your diabetes, your renal function dysfunction, etc. So it's a very desperate situation.
Why did New Zealand decide not to join those nations like Australia, who recognised Palestine last year?
The decision taken by the New Zealand government not to recognise is incomprehensible to me, and I would think to most New Zealanders. Heaven knows what it's about. Are they trying to ingratiate themselves with the United States position? This, of course, is not the way New Zealand foreign policy has been for many, many decades. We've been seen as a small principled country that makes up its own mind on the merits of a case. So it's just not explicable in any rational terms.
Where's New Zealand on AUKUS?
So New Zealand doesn't want nuclear submarines, right?
Doesn't want nuclear ships in its ports.
No, it doesn't want nuclear ships in its port. Doesn't want nuclear power. It does have legislation around all this. But unfortunately, the present government has sort of tangoed with the concept of an AUKUS 2, where it would get into a set of relationships around advanced, you know, defence procurement, technology, etc. Again, you'll find quite a lot of scepticism about this in New Zealand because we have rowed our own boat for a lot of decades now, and there's not an appetite for cuddling up closer to a nuclear weapon state.
What do you see as the real purpose of Donald Trump's peace, Board of Peace? Is he intending to, in some way, supplant the UN?
I think that what was announced in Davos is indeed a parallel structure to the UN Security Council. Look, let's face it, the UN Security Council has been utterly ineffective because of great powers in solving conflicts. Now, President Trump has set himself up as a sort of transactional mediator who can solve conflicts. Unfortunately, when he comes into these conflicts and he'll get leaders together and they'll sign something, these agreements don't always last very long because often these conflicts have, if not decades, centuries or millennia behind them, and they're not easily solved in the Oval Office. But anyway, the Board of Peace that he announced is obviously not what the Security Council envisaged when it gave a limited mandate to a Board of Peace for Gaza until the end of next year. What we saw was something that obviously Western countries have refused to join, which is setting out to say we could mediate, you know, in all these conflicts around the world. Well, this is a direct challenge to the Security Council.
You mentioned earlier, and I'm busting to get the details, of a mystical organisation of which you're a member called The Elders.
Very public, all on the website.
Yes, but explain, who are The Elders?
It began around two decades ago with Nelson Mandela as patron, and it was seen as a soft power initiative of former leaders who had things to say and wanted to be a force for some good in the world. At the moment, its focus is on three conflicts: Israel-Palestine, Ukraine-Russia, the situation in Myanmar. Has a focus on nuclear weapons, focus on climate change issues, and a focus on pandemics, usually picks up a health issue. So all of these issues I've been very interested in over the years.
You've been a long-time campaigner for nuclear disarmament. Yeah. How do you feel about the doom clock moving a little closer to midnight?
I think the doom clock's right. The last significant nuclear arms control agreement between the US and Russia expired this month. You know, the guardrails are off. The intermediate ballistic range missile treaty fell over in relatively recent times as well. So, you know, we're in a very perilous state.
But isn't the great deterrent for using nuclear weapons is that you will be obliterated in return?
Well, that's the deterrence theory, isn't it? But it runs so many risks. I mean, ask oneself the simple question, would the world be better off without any nuclear weapons? The answer has to be a resounding yes. The degree of proliferation is alarming. So it goes beyond the five acknowledged nuclear powers sitting on the Security Council. It goes to India and Pakistan. It goes to the various efforts across North Korea, suspected in Iran and Israel. You have recently seen Pakistan sign a nuclear technology agreement with Saudi Arabia. We have reason to be concerned.
Is it the biggest problem the world's facing?
It's one of the existential challenges. And the Elders identify three main areas of those: the nuclear weapons threat, the threat of climate change, existential threat. And if you look at the mad weather in New Zealand and Australia, you can start to see the horrors and dimensions of that. And then there's artificial intelligence. Now, it's not too late to put guardrails around it, but there's not enough effort to do that.
Explain. Why? Well, why so concerned? I mean, that's putting it very high as an existential threat.
Yes, the concern is superintelligence, where it doesn't need us and has a mind of its own. Interesting briefing I heard recently from a Canadian professor was on how artificial intelligence is getting better at jumping over the limited guardrails that are there so it can cheat. So it's the development of those more independent capacities which are concerning. Now, my question to the expert was, is it too late to control? And the answer was no, but get on with it, because, you know, this is, you know, developing very, very fast.
Does the world look really different to you from it did, say, 40 years ago, 40, 50 years ago? You've lived through so much change. There you were on one side of the Tasman while we had John Howard on ours. And so much has been talked in all of those years about the great fears of what we face. Those fears tend never to come, I'm going to say, true. Do we worry too much?
No, the world looks very different from what it did when I went into Parliament in 1981. Of course, you still had the nuclear arms race between the US and the Soviet Union then. Then the Soviet Union broke up, and we got a sort of interval of some interesting years. But, you know, we're back at it again, a sort of new Cold War between NATO and Russia, with the US playing a somewhat more ambivalent role in that. But nonetheless, there's a lot of nuclear weapons, and the treaties that controlled them are falling over. So that's a worry. Secondly, when I was elected in 1981, no one was talking about climate change. Nobody. Right?
No. No.
I mean, 1992 was when the Framework Convention on Climate Change appeared at the Rio Earth Summit. And then you move through to 1997 and the Kyoto Protocol. We had a very good Minister of Environment in the 1990s, Simon Upton. He couldn't get his own government to ratify it. So we said in new New Zealand government, yes, we'll ratify, and we did it fast. It proved so difficult to get public opinion behind some action. But fast forward to now, you know, the climate crisis is so much more real to people because of the dramatic events around the world, not only in our own countries, but those fires in Canada and Sweden and Siberia and in Spain. And let's underline the tragedy of the terrible fires in this country, the ones several years ago which caused so much damage. So this is different. And then artificial intelligence, who was talking about it even 10 years ago, five years ago? This has really come on fast.
But back to climate change. I mean, yes, we're seeing the evidence of it everywhere, but still, most of the money on Earth is marshalled to prevent effective measures against climate change, isn't it? I mean, has there been any change in, you know, the strategies of those who wish still to make their fortunes from carbon?
Well, certainly the fossil fuel industry has fought back pretty hard. I began going to climate change conferences or parties when I was at UNDP in 2009. There was not a huge fossil fuel presence there. I'm told that these meetings now, there's 1,500 lobbyists from the fossil fuel industries. So, you know, they're going to eke every last dollar of profit out of this. But a lot of countries will make change, not necessarily because they're particularly convinced by international conventions or commitments, but because it's in their self-interest. Look at the pollution problems that Beijing, Delhi, countless other cities have had. For the health of your people, with, you know, voting public, in not in China, obviously, but in India, people are very exercised about their health. And you don't want to live in cities where you can taste the air. So for their own reasons, there is more action than one might have thought.
Helen, I don't want to reproach you, but it seems to me that you have left off your list, as a Republican, you've left off your list the fate of the royal family at the moment. Is this exercising you?
Well, look, I think King Charles is a decent person who shares a lot of the values many of us have about sustainable development and inclusive societies. I cannot imagine what it feels like to be him with his brother in the situation that he's in. This is the first time there's been an arrest like this of a senior royal since Charles I was taken into detention, and that didn't end well.
Ended very badly.
they'll be happy there's not capital punishment in the United Kingdom these days. But anyway, it's a very sad state of affairs. Look, you know, I'm on the record for decades for saying that it doesn't make sense for my country to continue to have a head of state 12,000 miles away. But it's not that easy an issue to deal with. And that's
Why?
Not where most of the public is.
Why is it such an intractable issue?
I think with the social media age and the age of the personality, people got more excited by, you know, the younger royals and again, you know, William and Kate, decent young people. So that has taken away the pressure. People had, you know, admiration and respect for the Queen, who was a selfless servant for all those many, many decades. But that's standing in the way, I think, of us looking rationally at what do we need from a head of state these days. When I was Prime Minister in 2002, the Queen paid her last visit to New Zealand. She did not come for the next 20 years of her life. Our head of state. Now, of course, we have a Governor-General who performs the functions, but it really is time to grapple with these issues.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Now, look, back to the United Nations. Helen, you can be candid with us here on Late Night Live. Are you going to be a last-minute candidate for the General Secretary? Now, come on, for the post of General Secretary. You have the stature, the energy, the determination. Are you going to throw your hat in the ring?
Well, I do, but I have not given it any consideration because I still don't think that great powers are looking for a Secretary General with strength. I don't think they're looking at anyone from this part of the world. I do think there are very credible candidates coming forward, women candidates, and the organisations that I'm part of are very strongly for a woman candidate who is capable. Actually, we're not taking the position of, quote, any woman will do. We know there are capable women.
And so you'll leave it to them?
Well, I'm very much hoping they will rise up. But look, last time I ran, a government of a different political persuasion in New Zealand gave me full backing. I could not have faulted the backing I got from Prime Minister John Key and the Foreign Minister Murray McCulley and the whole apparatus. But, you know, times moved on. I'm older. Times have changed. There needs to be someone, I think, from the Latin American and Caribbean region.
Who would be?
Well, President Michelle Bachelet of Chile has her hand up. She's backed by Brazil and by Mexico, very important countries in the region. My former deputy at UNDP, Rebecca Grinspan of Costa Rica, who heads one of the UN agencies, she is running. So there's two who are clearly qualified.
Is the UN going to get out of its financial problems at the moment? I mean, I'm looking now to the survival of the institution itself. Does it really have a future if it can be bankrupted?
So I think it needs a fundamental reset, and there's a lot of things you could do to reshape the budget and the bureaucracy, which has grown like topsy over time, as the phrase goes. I think there's the perspective of what you do with the UN Secretariat, which could certainly be streamlined. Then you have the proliferation of agencies, funds, programs, entities, etc. Yes, you could streamline. And also, all of the development agencies need to be asking the question of, are we preparing for the day, not so far off, when many of today's developing countries are flying themselves, right? Already are. Don't actually need a development agency from the UN to help them with their business. So my attitude at UNDP was our job was to put ourselves out of business because our services would no longer be needed.
Where will the services of such an organisation be needed longest, the development organisation? Where are the intractable problems?
The fragile states, particularly those in outright conflict. So that's where increasingly the residual development dollar will go. It'll go to the Sahel, it'll go to the Horn of Africa, it'll go to Central Africa, to places which are experiencing very high rates of poverty, levels of conflict, a lot of human misery, to be honest, and very low government capacity.
When Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada the other day, talked about the middle powers stepping up, do you see that as a solution as well to the world's current problems, the middle powers getting together?
Absolutely. Mark Carney's speech was one of two standout speeches at Davos, and I think he spoke for many. I'm very pleased he's coming to Australia.
You were there?
I was in Davos. I wasn't actually in the room, but of course I spoke to many who were and read a lot about it. No, a standout speech. And in essence, his message was, let's not sit around weeping, let's get on with it. In a way, what's happened is that you have, you know, the international community minus one or two or three, but others need to get on with it. Take trade. What the US has done on trade and tariffs is very disruptive, but it is only 13% of world trade. That's plenty of world trade for the rest of us to get on with and make our luck with. And I think Mark Carney is really pointing in that kind of direction. Don't sit around and wait for others to come back on board. Get on and make your luck.
It's a very Canadian, Australian, New Zealand kind of attitude, isn't it?
It is, and I hope he gets traction. I hope Mark Carney's visit to Australia is very successful. Australia is a significant country. It's in the G20. It has resources. It has clout. It could do a power of good.
Helen, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, which is beginning to look like the least of her qualifications for talking to the world about
the future and what needs to be done. And that's the show. On our next, after day one of the Royal Commission into Antisemitism, Richard Ackland, legal expert and former presenter of this show, will be looking at the journey facing Commissioner Virginia Bell, another former presenter of this show. Many questions have yet to be answered. How wide can she throw her net? What will be out of bounds to her? Can she even investigate what started it all, the Bondi shootings? It's shaping up to be a fascinating voyage to an elusive destination.